Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we're diving straight, no chaser, into the delicious crossover of the food and jazz worlds.
And I think that sense of nostalgia is what makes it hard to do New Orleans food well, because people just have these memories of these dishes. Certainly people from New Orleans, like, you're never going to make, you know, a gumbo as good as their mother or grandmother made, right?
Comfort food, you got to get your hands dirty, and the jazz is musicians. It's like, it all goes together very well, you know?
Check out Meatin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacking Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On this week's episode, Darren heads down to San Juan, Puerto Rico to connect with Paulina Escanes, the chef owner of the critically acclaimed restaurant Paulina Escanes Gourmandise. Paulina hails from Guadalajara, Mexico, where she was instilled with an early love of good eating, having been raised in a family of gourmands. A longtime resident of Puerto Rico, she stepped into the restaurant business first as a baker before eventually opening her eponymous restaurant in 2018. Later on in the episode, we are joined by our studio engineer, Jeet, as we both interview Sarah Jaffe, who joins us live for performance of songs from her Smut EP, and discusses the hospitality of Texas musicians and army crawling your way through the tough parts of life. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
You don't shock me. But you surprised me. Reality TV, there's not much going on. Same words, same song. Just like everyone else. But it feels important to see. Cause you're important to me. Important to me.
I want you
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are so happy and honored to be joined by Paulina Escanez, chef and owner of Paulina Escanez Gourmandise from San Juan, Puerto Rico. She's on the phone with us right now. Paulina, welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. So I know that you're based in San Juan, but you were originally born in Guadalajara, Mexico. What was life like growing up? What was food's influence on you when you were younger? What were your earliest food memories?
In Mexico we have the fortune that we have everything fresh all the time. You know, fruits, vegetables, meats, seafood, everything travels so well. And each region has their own specific kind of cuisine. And the one in Guadalajara, I think, is the second largest city in Mexico. So we do have a lot of international influence. And my family basically is from Spain. So I grew up with 100% Mexican street food when I used to go out. And then at my home, my grandma and my aunts and mother, they used to cook, like a Spanish-oriented kind of a cuisine. And on top of that, I have three uncles that they are very, very foodies. Actually, two of them hunt for hobby. So whatever they used to hunt, they used to flew it over Mexico and we'll have it, cooked. So I was introduced to weird, just to say that term, because when you are a child, a faisan is not that common, right? So I was introduced to very different flavors since I was a kid. And being a Mexican, I think that influence, I had a great influence in my palate, because in Mexico, we are not picky eaters. We eat everything. So basically, is that what I have in my memories.
So when did you start getting into the kitchen? Were you helping out when the uncles were coming back from the hunts? Were you helping out with the aunts and your mothers and your grandmothers? When did you start rolling up your sleeves and getting into the kitchen?
My mother has a sister. She's like 10 years younger than her. So she got married, had a baby, and I was her helper. So I used to go out after my school, and she used to cook for her husband very, very gourmet things. So she used to have all the food and wine magazines, the gourmet magazines. So I used to go to the dessert pages, and I used to reply it, the recipes that caught my eye. And every single time, mostly, of the time that I tried the recipes, they came out, like, so good. And they were looking exactly as, in the magazines. So at that very young age, maybe when I was, like, 12 years, I knew that I was good at cooking. And so every weekend, I used to bake for my friends and my family. And then I took off. I finished high school. I moved to Boston. And then from Boston, I moved to Puerto Rico. And the first time that they invited me to have a dinner in a friend's house, I went to a bakery and I saw the options that they had. And I wasn't satisfied with that. So what I did is, like, I bought all the ingredients and went home. And basically, I just baked, like, basic brownies that my mother and I used to bake a lot. And people in that dinner, a lot of chefs went. So those were amazed by the taste of the brownies, and they every time that I had parties, I became famous because of my desserts. So when they opened the restaurant, I'm talking about like three different chefs in Puerto Rico, they hired me to bake for them all the desserts. So that's why I started, focusing on the cuisine talent that I had, and put aside my master, which is in art, nothing to do with cooking. I actually never took a cooking class in my life. Everything's from practicing and reading books and stuff. And I started my career in the business, and I used to have a company, little company, that used to provide desserts. And after around 7 years or eight that I had it, I decided for personal reasons to go back home, to live in Mexico again after many, many years. And I sold the company, the recipes, everything. I went back, and 4 months later, I came to Puerto Rico to visit a friend and to stay maybe like 1 or 2 months in Puerto Rico. And I met this wonderful guy, which I'm with right now. And he knew that I was very good at, baking and cooking and everything and entertaining. So he basically said, why don't you give it a try and have a restaurant? You'll be amazing, to do that. Let's begin with a very small concept, which it was basically breakfast and lunch, and that was it. So I was home by 6 p.m. every single day, which was amazing. I really liked that. And on the weekends, I had a brunch. So I started with that, and I said, I'm going to cook because, remember, I'm not a chef. I'm a trained chef. So I'm going to cook like whatever, our friends have when they go to our house. And if people like this kind of food, which feels fresh and non-pretentious, very nothing fried, very easygoing, then I think my concept might be good, to have a serious restaurant with a lot of seating and then bar and later on nightlife and so on. So basically I started with a very small restaurant. Hurricane Maria came. And we had to close it. Nothing happened to the restaurant per se, but the area in which my restaurant was, it was a little bit affected. So it was a challenge for us, to run it again. So we started looking for a new place and found this amazing place, which has like a lot of communities and schools and hospitals and stuff. And we gave it a try a year ago, and it's been a fantastic road. I gotta say that it's been really great. People really like, So sorry.
No. I mean, that's amazing. What has the biggest learning been since before and after the hurricane? What did you have to shift with your business? What did you find that you could keep the same? What are some of the things that you were able to do or made you think about differently about running a business?
After Maria, everyone was scared. It was very difficult to, especially my kind of cuisine, which is very farm to table. Most of the crops were destroyed. So it was a challenge for me to find that quality of organic local produce. It was a challenge, definitely. So I was a little bit scared, but because I closed it and then I had this construction going on, I opened the restaurant after, I will say, almost a year after Maria. So it gave me a year so everyone else got on track again. And by the time that I opened the restaurant, I found it easier, but I was scared. And by the time that Maria, before and after, I will say it's been incredible how this kind of industry more now than ever. I've seen the change. We understand how important it is to buy from local producers instead of going to Costco and, you know, buy, yes, cheaper. I wouldn't say that. But it's, you know, it's not ours. It's not ours product. So basically it gave everyone the chance to try small agricultures and farmers and so on and gave them a hand. So I think from that time on, it's been growing up, like nonstop. I'm amazed on the versatility that now I have on products, even before Maria. So it's been great.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that for people who may not understand what it means to run a farm-to-table restaurant in San Juan and how much you can rely on farmers and then how much you had to rely on big box supermarket chains and how you are creatively solving for that problem?
Well, because this is an island, we have everything, you know, coming, you know, by ships. So, first of all, nothing, it was ours before, and everything, you know, nothing's fresh, really fresh. So, just for that, having to change, you know, our concept, and to support local communities have been a little bit more expensive, actually, for us. I mean, my cost of a pound per local greens, like versus imported from supermarkets, it's ridiculous, the price. And a lot of people will say in this industry that I'm crazy, or the people that support this kind of movement, we are crazy. But we are not. We are really gambling on the benefit that this island, it has to produce their own things. Because Dominican Republic, which is a neighbor island, they do produce a lot of things. So we do have the qualities on the soil to do that. We just have a little bit more money, you know, investors' money to have crops and tools and education for the people. And for, you know, for regular people, not just for industry people, for regular people to really look after what it's from here, you know? Like, I know that I want to eat maybe some blueberries, you know, during February, but if they are not in season, why to get them and why to fly them from, you know, from the other side of the world? And we have to understand that. And it is a big commitment. And as I'm repeating, the prices that I pay for the things, they are not, you know, now they are not they are not 100% beneficial for my pocket, but they are very beneficial for the future of this island, which I believe, you know, it has everything to go on. And the chef that I admire the most on the island, they support this kind of movement. So I think we are a small community, like, you know, like one by one, and then it's word of mouth. Like, actually today I was getting some things for my restaurant in a restaurant store, and we were three chefs, and we were exchanging phone numbers of the goat cheese lady, of the artisanal bread, of the... It was amazing to see that. We didn't see this, you know, like 3 years ago. Never, because you used to go to chain supermarkets or these big companies that sell you import the stuff. So I think, I mean, I'm very proud that I support this kind of local people.
I love it. We're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to come back. I want to talk a little bit more about why cooking speaks so naturally to you and the new menu that you just updated with your restaurant. We have a song from the musical archive. Yeah. Here on Snacky Tunes on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Paulina Escanez. Paulina Escanez Gourmandiz from San Juan, Puerto Rico. I want to go back to a little bit about this intuitive relationship that you have with cooking and your ability to craft flavors. What is it about the culinary arts that you connect with so well? Why do you think it's come so naturally to you, not just as a home cook, but also as a restaurateur and chef?
I remember since I was a kid, I exactly knew what I wanted to eat. And I think it is a gift that I understand. And I don't want to sound preppy or anything, but I understand why the cheese has to be like super melted. And for example, every time that I go to a restaurant, my husband laughs because I'm very specific about when I order like a hamburger. I will say, please just make sure that the cheese is like melted. And it sounds ridiculous, but if it's not, you will taste another thing. And I don't know why I know it. And I've been developing maybe my palate by not being shy and try very different kinds of cuisines and spices. So I kind of know if there's heat, if there's acid, if you need to add a little bit of sweetness or fat, or I don't know. I just try and try, and just by tasting things, even in my kitchen, when I give out the recipes, I mean the morning after or during the shift, I will go and try the sauces or all the preparations, and just by sometimes maybe just by looking at the things, I know that something is not right. Like they need more cilantro, they need more salt, they added too much water, for example. It is just something that you know. And because I used to bake a lot of desserts, my sugar tolerance is very low right now. So everything sugary, I will try to avoid it. So I will say no, less sugar, because too much sugar, it will at the end, you will just eat it for finishing, the slice or whatever you're having. And if you balance, the sweetness, you might have the whole dessert or things like that. I just know. And I also read a lot, and I follow a lot of chefs, trained chefs. And I don't mind asking for tips, to my friends that they are trained. So I'm very open about that. And the things that I cook at the restaurant, they are the things that I like to eat. It's as simple as that. I do not cook anything that I wouldn't eat or that I wouldn't crave. So that's very important for me too. At the beginning, it was a challenge because a lot of people, they suggest you create a menu that people they are used to, or that will be easier for them. And at the beginning, just by the names, I'm gonna give you an example. For at beginning at the restaurant, instead of aguachile, which is a term that we use in Mexico for a special kind of a ceviche, raw fish, and I had it on the menu, and no one asked for it, just for the name. So my husband said, why don't you say, it's like a Mexican ceviche, and it will sell better. And I thought about it, and at the end, I'm not here to educate people. They can do, of course, whatever they want. But yes, it's my responsibility as well to pass on generations that this is not called Mexican ceviche. It's called aguachile, So,
yeah.
So it's been, it's been that for me.
So as a restaurateur, you've had your restaurant for over a year. That's open, and you're currently changing the menu or have just gone through a menu change. Can you talk to me a little bit about the evolution of the restaurant, about where you started and where you are now and where you want to go?
Yes, at the beginning, well, you know, because it was my first full-on restaurant, like, you know, like 7 days a week, lunch and dinner, and then brunch, lunch and dinner on the weekends. It was very complicated, you know, the first year, just to have your own team, organizing everything, correcting the recipes, training, retraining, you know, how is that? So I create a very simple menu, maybe just, you know, I had just one filet mignon, one kind of fish, one salad, for example, one dish of the day, one soup, and then like three or four appetizers. That was it. And now after a year, because my restaurant became this community restaurant where people and neighbors and teachers and doctors and whoever is, you know, I mean, a very transitable street. So it became this restaurant that you go maybe 2-3 times per week. So, and for these regular clients, they used to ask, like, Pau, like, would you mind, you know, adding, like, maybe a lamb, or would you adding maybe another fish, or maybe another pasta, or they were asking for it. And I became, you know, open to the petition. And also because, you know, the chef's life is like this, you get bored as well, you know, to have the same menu, the same items for a year. So I decided, you know, now that it's, you know, summertime and it's kind of like slower season for us, I will retrain, I will create, you know, like another recipes. So basically it grew up like 50% my menu, and I have many, many, many options right now for vegan, for vegetarians, for pescatarians, for families. I created a place that they do share. And so that was a pretty nice, you know, transformation of my menu. And I'm very happy with it. The regulars are happy with it. The tourists that they come, I didn't take out the, you know, the most famous dishes. I kept them. And basically I added a lot of dishes. So they are, you know, it's a win-win situation for everyone. So they are very happy with that.
I love it. So as you look towards the future of both the restaurant and then also San Juan and this new chef farm, other chef ecosystem, what are you most hopeful about? What would you like to see happen? And how do you see your role in all of it?
I think my dream, I call it Paulina's Canes Gourmandis, because the gourmandis, it refers to like a gourmet person, basically. So this first restaurant, it has, because people ask me, you know, like, but is it Mexican? Is it Italian? Is it no? And I'm like, no, it's, you know, cooking from all over, basically the places that I visited, and then I fall in love with the plates, and then I came and replicate them, right? Kind of. And this is the restaurant that I try everything, and then I would like to have, for example, Paulina's Canes taco place, or Paulina's Canes Thailand spot, or you know what I mean? I would like to become a brand. I am thrilled that I'm Mexican, and Puerto Rico's been my home from the past. I think I'm going to be 17 years here. So I really feel like this is home to me. And I want to make this project, you know, like a very successful one, which maybe I can have a Paulina's Canes bakery as well, which I, you know, which it was my first thing to do here. And I do have an amazing partners. They are my best friends. They help me all the way through. My husband he's amazing. He runs the money the farming. So I keep on track of that. And he keeps on track of, you know, whatever selling, whatever it's ordered most or so on. So I would like to be a small brand, maybe give a, give classes, like a simple ones, you know, that they can recreate something that that I serve at the restaurant, which is basically like a homemade meal. So it's very easy for people, I think, to feel that I can give them classes or guide them a little bit, you know, into this experience of become a good cook.
I love it. Well, Paulina, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us. If people wanted to visit the restaurant or find out more about you online, how can they find you? Instagram, Facebook, what's the best way?
Yes, we do have all the social media platforms. The Instagram one is Paulina Gourmandis with a Z-E at the end. And then we do have our website, which is paulinagourmandis.com. So they can go there and check out, you know, my photos and my menus. And if they come to Puerto Rico, please let me know that you heard, you know, this interview, and I will make sure that you will be treated amazingly well, and I'll be happy to meet you. So
please
come
to
Puerto Rico. You're going to love it.
I hope to get down there very soon. Thank you so much. We have a live song. Yes, I can't wait to eat the food. We have a live song from the archives and then a live band in studio at Snacky Tunes at heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Lisa Held, and I'm the host of The Farm Report here on HRN. The Farm Report is a show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Expect from-the-field insights as guests explore how producing fresh, delicious food relates to environmental and community sustainability, justice, and better health. You can find The Farm Report wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz.
And I'm Jeet Paul. And in the studio today, we have an amazing musician, Sarah Jaffe. So it says that you're from Texas.
From Texas,
all right.
Yes.
And you've been writing music for a long time.
A long time.
All right. And your resume is quite impressive, as I see. It says that you scored and contributed original music to the independent film Never Going Back. You co-wrote and sang on Bad Guy by Eminem, which is insane.
It was a wild card, yeah.
Yeah, no shit, right? And you also contributed to the voice of the Blue Umbrella.
Yes, John Bryan.
That's amazing.
It was cuckoo.
So what was it like growing up in Texas?
I love Texas. It's, my childhood was, it was, you know, pretty boring. But I think I just had so much space to do whatever I wanted, and all that space kind of left me to my imagination, which I think was really kind of pivotal for what I wanted to do. So
a lot of time
on my hands. Yeah.
So when did you get into music then?
I started pretty straight. Because I moved to Los Angeles when I graduated high school. So I was 18 and I got my ass kicked. Los Angeles kicked my ass, man. So I came back after almost a year there. I really got my start in Texas in like 2005, 2006.
What happened in LA?
Oh, just like a slew of parking tickets. And I had a job. I literally had a job for 6 hours and then I got fired. I worked at a bagel shop in Santa Monica and I told him I couldn't work Sundays. And this is when I was working. And he was like, oh, well, then I'm going to have to let you go. And I was like, oh, my God. It was eye-opening. I think I just thought that I would go there and it would be, like, just naming lights and amazing. And the seas would part for me. And that is not the case. It's never been the case. So it was a good learning experience. And I came back to Texas really just with a lot of ambition and just my sights set on, you know, achieving, making my first record and then the second. So it's just been like a really wonderful progression and a lot of amazing lessons along the way.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
But before Los Angeles, like, how did you get into music? Like, what was your first artist that really kind of drove you into like, oh, wow, this is something I want to do for the rest of my life?
I think it really just came from my appreciation, like, mm-hmm. that my parents gave me.
Are your parents musical?
Yeah, my mom's side especially. I mean, I started singing probably 13, 14, in churches with her. So I think it was probably them. So, I mean, it's been, I mean, you did ask me, like, when did I actually start, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say like 13, 14. I just started doing those kinds of shows. And yeah.
You said your mom's side of the family was musical. Who and in what way?
What did you ask?
Your mom's side of the family was musical.
Oh, yeah. My mom was just constantly singing. And
your mom sang all the time?
All the time, yeah. In church, she would, you know, she had a really lovely alto voice. And so the church choir was always like, Malia, you take the lead on this one. So she always had the church solo. And so watching her, and also, you know, my cousins were very, very musical. And I always looked up to them. So it was just that side of the family. And my dad's side of the family really kind of gave me the starting out taste, like a ton of James Taylor, Cat Stevens.
Oh, nice.
So that's kind of how I, you know, stumbled to playing folk music in the very, very beginning. And
do you remember when you first started recording?
Yeah, there was a friend of mine that I had in high school that I would just go to his house, and he had like a little just computer set up. So I started recording then, and I shortly after recorded an EP that was in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think the first EP really kind of launched the next full-length record, which was Suburban Nature, which was mm-hmm. in 2011, and that's when I really started touring.
And this was all in, in Texas?
Yep, all in Texas.
What was it about the Texas music scene that you felt was more opportunist for you to develop your musical career versus the short stint in LA?
Just the musicians that I met, there was, I think Texas kind of lends itself to this hospitable attitude. And so there was a lot of accessibility just with the people that I met that were just down to play. Like it wasn't about money, or no one had any preconceived notions about like what was in it for them. So I really, it was just like hospitable people that were down to play or down to record on records. And I've always found Texas musicians to be like that. They're still like just some of the nicest, coolest. And Rob, who's playing drums with me today, you're Texas baby. So, I mean, and I've met my whole band just because everyone just wanted to play music together. And it's just a very, very egoless kind of mindset in a lot of the scenes. Dallas, Denton, yeah, great places. Yeah.
That's really cool. You want to jump to a song?
Yeah, can we hear a song?
Sure.
I'm going to jump back in there.
Hi, G.
What are you going to play for us first?
I'm going to play a song with Rob called Dark Energy.
Dark energy, stay away from me. I'm going to fight for myself. Lethargy.
Go, you can go to hell. You're
Right as I opened my eyes, I watched someone take such a delicious-looking bite. It was the first thing I saw, and I.
Do you always sing with your eyes closed?
Yeah, I do.
So eyes open, bite of pizza.
Eyes open, bite of pizza. Time for a song. Eyes closed.
It's just getting you in the space.
I don't know. It's just something that I do. I prefer to like think about the song in like a very focused way, and for some reason, like not seeing anything really helps.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the two EPs that came before. This is Better.
Yeah.
Sounded like it was a very, very difficult EP to write. Do you want to like talk a little bit about the process of that?
Sure. I was going through a icky breakup, and at that exact time, I had just started to write for other artists. I just finished the score that I did for Never Going Back.
Mm-hmm.
And just really loved the top lining, like writing songs for other people. I loved that environment, and just kind of more so the headspace that it put me in, which was, you know, sometimes the more you think about yourself and your song, like the more your ego drives it. And yeah. I like just the creative aspect of just jumping into writing with no ego. And that world just kind of put me in that constant mindset of like just like churning it out and creating a schedule and a routine for myself. And so I started writing these pop songs with a good friend and a great producer. His name's Aaron Kelly. And during this process, I was like, oh no, this feels like something that I want to release. I want to perform these songs. I want to take them on the road. I just was attached to them mainly because of what I was going through. And so I ended up kind of using this whole top lining process as a vessel to get these songs out. So I was just like, well, fuck it. We'll just release these songs and put them as two EPs. And that's what happened.
What was it like working with Aaron?
Lovely. He's I'm filled with gratitude that having met him. And he's just a cool producer.
Like, is he from Texas as well?
Yeah.
A lot of Texas people in your life.
Yeah, and he works a lot, in the commercial world, and mm-hmm. so there's a quickness that really satiates, because I'm just impatient in the studio. Like, I need to hear something
yeah.
a certain way, and a lot of times I have trouble getting there mentally, just to make that mental jump a lot of times and translate the ideas that I have in my head a lot. And Aaron and I just have a really good kind of ping pong banter relationship.
Like, did you come to the table with like lyrics, or did he come with,
we started each day, like he was like, what kind of song do you want to make?
And I would
be like, oh, let's do more up tempo. Like he would just kind of make a beat, and I would just start singing melodies. A lot of these songs were just started as melodies, and then I would just kind of go back and insert the filling and play keys on top of it, or but they're all built around beat.
Interesting.
And just not hearing, sometimes a bass line will help, but I need as much space within that beat so that I can just kind of create a melody, verse, chorus, and so on.
And how do you capture a song about heartbreak?
I mean, you gotta go through that shit, right? I really do think that it's so grossly precious, but that's where you are. You just, there's no denying it. And so that's where I was. And it was also kind of a lifesaver. It was a way for me to get out of it. Because once I started making music, and it just kind of cleared the pathway a little bit for me to see that... it's just something I can depend upon. It's just been so healthy for me to have that as just a spine in my life, that I can create something from just a gross situation. So I think to write something, that's heartfelt or about heartbreak, you got to feel that.
Yeah, it sounds like it was very cathartic.
Yeah.
And so going from that to the new EP, Smut... what was the actually, let's talk about that first. Very interesting way that title came about. Do you want to tell the story?
Yeah, actually, Danny, my girlfriend's roommate, got this. She, what part of Virginia is she from?
Roanoke.
Yeah. She got this voicemail from someone in Roanoke, Virginia. And it wasn't, Katie had no idea who this woman is. Oh, shit, I gave her what name. She had no idea who this woman was, but it was very much like a Virginia accent. And it also sounded like a family member that I've, a few actually, that I have in Beaumont, Texas. Just country, country ass accent. And it's actually the voicemail that you hear. I was like, oh, shit, Danny, is there any way? I was in the middle of like sampling shit. I just love to sample and make my own samples. And I was like, can you please ask your roommate if I can chop this up and stretch it out and make this into the intro song? It's so this voicemail is how I landed on that title. I was like, oh, this is amazing.
Are you still reading smut? Give me a call. I got my cell phone. I love you. Bye.
That was great. That was amazing. I'm so happy she let you use that. And how did it change? You know, you went through the cathartic of the previous EPs, and what joy filled this one, or how did you feel elated in this process?
Oh God, man, in so many ways. It was like, you know, like those moments in your life when you like army crawl your way out of a situation, and there's just like a part of you that's like, I'm alive, you know, like music was this like breath into my, and you know, into my depleted world, where I just started writing again and just really taking in every opportunity. So I was just having a lot of fun. And so I've, once again, like the music that I was writing was just reflecting that in every way. And it was the first time I had been single in a long time. And I was living alone for the first time in my adult life, which was incredible. And of course, since moving here, my situation is very different. But I had, you know, like an amazing apartment and was living downtown in Dallas, Texas, and just really soaking up every opportunity and every like studio opportunity, just saying yes to pretty much everything, and just felt so rewarded during that time, and wanted to make a really funny piece.
You worked with Aaron on this too, right?
Yeah.
Was the approach any different than the last one?
Yeah, I mean, there's always just a bit more confidence with each time you record, just because you know that something can be transformed from scrap.
Yeah.
You know, all I had was a voicemail, and we made something that was so fucking funny and cool. And yeah, it was just, I think I just felt more confident about what I could make.
Do you guys like sit in a room and be like, hey, this is what I'm feeling, and you guys just talk a bit, and
then
it
kind of
just
weird. It's exactly what it is. It's just like Aaron and I are just kind of like an unlikely pair. Like, I don't know. I mean, I feel like a lot of times when you walk into a studio, there's a lot of times where you don't know somebody.
Yeah.
And you can just sit down and it's like a conversation. So Aaron and I just like, we have a lot to talk about, and we just get a lot done.
And the music kind of grows out of that?
Yeah. Wow. It just stems out of beats with no melody or an idea that I've had.
Do you guys put like a lot of thought into like the kind of chord progressions or cadences that you're going to go with?
Yes.
So with this EP being a lot different than the previous one, what was the approach technically from like a musical perspective?
I mean, like for example, like with Important, I had this just moment when I was by myself in my apartment. I wrote the whole thing in my head. Mm. From like, I have like the recording from start to finish, of course without any instrumentation, so it's literally me, you know, just saying, you don't dun, 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 dun. Womp, womp, like just singing out these ideas that I can hear perfectly in my head. So then I took that recording of Important, of just me singing, took it to Aaron, and just basically we built a beat off of that, and then went back in And really, it's like trying to match pieces with just fucking cloud. Like, there's no solid form of melody. I don't know what notes I'm singing. So there would be a couple hours where I'm just like trying to find those four note progression on a keyboard, and which can take a while.
Yeah.
And then you start going on these rabbit trails of like, oh, this synth sounds amazing. And so it's just, you know, some days where it felt like we were just going on rabbit trail after rabbit trail. But once we got that solid form down, it's pretty, I mean, it's like the fun part. You get to put all the fix-ins and throw them in the mix. And I just wanted something with that song, with Important in particular, like a little bit of goof, you know, to kind of lift it out of itself. I wanted it to just be a fun record. And so there was just a lot of experimentation that really didn't see a full form until, you know, the last recording days. So
can we hear another song?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
I'm going to play a song from Smut. It's a song called One Hit, One Wonder.
Yeah, yeah. This feeling that I had pent up on the inside, the floor to the ceiling, at my body reeling. That's why I go hiding cold. Pull me close, my temperature rising. I say, give me your touch. Yeah, yeah. You're getting warmer. Pull me close. One hit, one wonder. 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 You're mine. It's a look that you give me. I see it deep in your eyes. Is your consolation to pass the time? Let's put it in motion. I'm secretly hoping that's why I go hiding gold. Put me close, my temperature rising. I say, give me your touch. You're getting warmer. One hit, one wonder. One hit, one wonder. You're mine. One hit, one wonder. 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 You're mine. One hit, one wonder. One hit, one wonder. One hit, one wonder.
So what's next for you musically?
Well, I mean, I would love to start recording again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
so soon.
yeah, I just, I really want to focus on kind of making a consistent schedule for myself. Mm-hmm. It's very easy for me to like release something and just kind of float into the abyss, like, and just be like, well, I did something. And then time passes and you're like, I should really be consistent with this and treat it like the job that it is. So I would like to, I mean, Rob and I have talked about getting together. I've got some shows coming up that I really want to put my creative focus on that first, but I imagine I'll start recording
some shows in New York?
No. In Texas, actually.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I'm going to do a little one-off here and there, cute little bop over and bop back.
Where and when?
Well, the big one that I'm getting ready for is I'm playing with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, which is like, I know, holy shit was my thought too. It's been a bucket lister for quite some time, and that's in February, but I'm, you know, working with the Dallas Symphony, so there's a lot of like arrangement, you know, string arrangement parts and just coordinating with.
They're going to do strings over your songs?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know.
Oh, that's super exciting.
I'm wigging out.
Are you going to be part of the whole arrangement and orchestration of it?
Yes.
Holy.
So I'm trying to just, you know. My brain is just so like military trained to be like, we're playing Phoenix, Arizona in a tiny little shithole. Like, give them rock, you know, like. So I'm really trying to like think about it in every detailed aspect just to elevate it from, you know, the usual set that I would play.
How are you going to balance the heartbreak songs with the Army Crawl happiness songs?
That's a great question. I am not quite sure yet. But the string players will have a lot to do with that. So I'm working on a lot of, the majority of where my mental space is now is like just like thinking about transitions.
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to visualize that and, because, I mean, there's so many times, like, where I have an idea of, like, something works so perfectly in my head. Like, everything's in the same key in my head. And so I'm really just focusing on how to make Clementine connect with small talk, you know? Like, how do I make that jump?
Jeez, you could tell, like, a whole narrative with all this, with all the music that you have. You could tell, you could, like, put on a, like a... like a Broadway musical show or something.
Well, I'm almost, I'm trying to think about it in that way. But when I start thinking about it in that way, I feel like my pretentiousness like just really comes to life. But there's no way not to be precious about it. Like when you're putting 30 of your own songs together, you're like, I am starring in my own musical. But I, you know, I'm just going to run with it. I'm just so thrilled about playing with the Dallas Symphony and all of my bandmates, my pals on stage. So I'm really trying to be diligent about every single aspect.
Sounds like it's going to be pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Yeah.
So we want to make sure we have time for one more song, but where can people find you? Where can they check out the tour dates? Where can they get tickets to the Dallas Symphony?
Yeah.
Listen to all 30 songs about you and your life.
God.
How's the sound coming out of someone else's mouth?
Terrible, my friend. Terrible. But you should buy tickets. You can find all of the links and info of showtimes on my website, which is www.sarahjaffe.com.
Any Instagram, Facebook?
Yeah, I do have Instagram. It's SayJaffe. Say Jaffe. That's where you can find me on Instagram, and Twitter's the same. So,
cool. Amazing. Well, big thank you to Chef Escanas. Sarah, thank you for joining us. Jeet.
Thank you.
Thank you, my man.
Thank you.
Welcome
Jeet.
To the hot seat. It's good to have you here. thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. What is the name of the last song?
We're going to close out with another song from Smut called Important.
Amazing. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
You don't shock me. But you surprise me. Reality TV is not much going on. Same words, same song.
just like everyone else, but it feels important to see. Cause you're important to me. Important to me.
Program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.